Ladies and gentlemen, on behalf of the Dean and Chapter, a very warm welcome to the first of our dialogues, the Westminster Abbey Institute dialogues, this evening. You're seated in the Lady Chapel of Westminster Abbey, and if you've not been in here before, very briefly, it was built during the reign of Henry VII, who is buried with his wife just behind us here. The magnificent ceiling is, in my view, and lots of people's views, the best in the country of its sort. The banners are those of the Order of the Bath. Many historic things have happened here, and tonight's lecture is but the latest of a distinguished series. Claire.
Well, good evening, everybody. I'm Claire Foster-Gilbert, the director of Westminster Abbey Institute, and I'm your chair and Mike's interlocutor this evening. The way we'll run this is that Mike and I will be in dialogue, or rather, I will ask Mike questions and he'll answer them very learnedly for about 40 to 45 minutes, and then we'll take questions and comments from the floor. We will finish absolutely no later than 7:45, and a little bit before if things begin to dry up. But I hope you'll join us in the Jerusalem Chamber afterwards for a glass of wine to continue the conversation. Westminster Abbey Institute was founded to nurture and revitalise what we have called the moral heart of public service and to promote the value of public service more widely. This autumn, we seek to raise the eyes and hearts of the hard-working public servants around Parliament Square, bound by circumstance to consider the self-interest of one nation, this one, as they battle their way to Brexit. While this work cannot be circumvented or ignored, there remain enormous challenges facing the whole of the human family. Not only do these challenges not go on hold while we deal with the immediate, narrow, politically febrile questions, they are the context within which those questions sit. How are we to continue to live on this planet, our home, without harming it? How are we to embrace the waves of humanity as they wash over different continents? How are we to identify the good that technology can do before it determines how we live? The real challenges of the 21st century brook no national boundaries. They cannot be faced by a broken, squabbling humanity. They appear intractable, impossible, vastly too large and too complex to be solved. They elude our Western secular rationalist approach of identifying a problem, capital P, applying reason, capital R, and finding a solution, capital S. In the face of their impossibility, it is perhaps unsurprising that we have ducked our heads and focused on smaller nationalistic questions. 100 years from now, will our historians tell the story that, unable to face the huge questions, humanity hunkered down, continuing to squabble over the colour scheme for the kitchen, as it were, while the house burned down? Will there be historians to tell our story in 100 years? If this ancient holy place means what it says, its walls echoing to centuries of heartfelt prayers for wisdom and guidance, here we can open our eyes to the universe, however frightening the prospect. Next week, we will concentrate on the challenges of migration, and in November, the challenges of technology. Tonight, this fragile earth, our threatened home, is our concern. I should emphasise at the outset that Westminster Abbey is not, and should not be, a policy think tank, and tonight will not propose policy solutions. But no one in this largely public servant audience should return to their desk unchanged by what they hear. We are working tonight at a deeper level of attitude and belief of how we see the world and our place in it. How we see the world determines how we behave towards it. It is a policy driver. With me, to raise our eyes and hearts to the question of the ecological crisis facing us, is Michael McCarthy, known to you as an environmental journalist and writer. A couple of years ago, while I was preparing my doctoral thesis on the environment, Mike's book, The Moth Snowstorm, leapt off the shelves of Hatchards in St Pancras Station, not because of its title, but because of its intriguing subtitle, The Moth Snowstorm, Nature and Joy. Nothing I had read hitherto had connected joy with nature, and I'm rather afraid I've made all of us very somber already. But tonight we're going to be talking about joy. I bought the book, and then I was too busy to read it. So luckily my partner Sean read it and told me I had to read it. So I did. He was quite right. It's one of the most important books of our time. Having read the book, I asked Mike to come and speak tonight. And the ground we will cover together will be a lot of what is in the book. So if your mind wanders, as well as being able to watch the film of the event tonight on the Abbey's YouTube channel, you can also buy the book later. So Mike, would you like to come to the lectern? Let's start.
Thank you, Claire. I'd like to say what an enormous pleasure and privilege it is to be in Henry VII's spectacular chapel. I also think I have to say that there won't be a lot of joy in my opening remarks. And I should say, thirdly, that I do have a great aversion to making any sort of bold statement. My answer to the question that's just been we are discussing, which is have we killed the planet, is just my view, and you may well think it's wrong, and feel free to disagree with me. But to answer this most dramatic of questions, it does seem to me that we find ourselves in a remarkable moment in human history. For we have undoubtedly set in motion a process which may well do irreversible damage to the Earth as we know it, and that is the runaway growth of the human enterprise. And by that I mean the expansion of the scale of human activities beyond the ability of the planet to contain them without its age-old life support systems breaking down. This process is already causing the clearly visible large-scale destruction of nature across the world. The Earth is very obviously being trashed by human activities, both in its habitats and in its species. Just to take habitats briefly, with the rainforests, for example, we can see that at least a fifth of the Amazon rainforest has already gone, and probably more than half of the rainforest of Indonesia. With the oceans, we can see that they are being strip-mined of their fish, with most commercial fish stocks now at danger levels or beyond, and that the beds of the shallower seas are now dreadfully degraded, while an estimated 5 trillion pieces of plastic waste are increasingly choking the very heart out of the marine environment. As for species, we know that, according to the relevant authorities, at least a fifth of all vertebrate species, that's mammals, birds, fish, reptiles and amphibians, are now threatened with extinction, and about a fifth of all plant species are facing the same fate. But the actual loss of numbers rather than species is very, very much greater. According to the Worldwide Fund for Nature, 2014, the number of creatures on earth had, in the previous 40 years, fallen by half. We have destroyed half the world's wildlife in the lifetime of many people here in this chapel tonight. And this, is, of course, a phenomenon we see exactly repeated in Britain. Just since 1970, we too, on our island, have lost more than half our wildlife. We have destroyed more than half of the birds, the wildflowers and the butterflies, which were still gracing the countryside when the beetles broke up. And since the beginning of the process responsible for that, intensive farming, in the late 40s, we have probably destroyed 75% or more. These losses are so egregious that we've already created two wholly new metaphors to describe them. One is the sixth great extinction, and the other is the Anthropocene. The first refers to the five cataclysmic life-extinguishing events in the Earth's prehistory, which we can observe in the geological record, when most then-current species died out, the last one being the impact of the asteroid or comet, which 65 million years ago is believed to have wiped out the dinosaurs. Such is the rate at which species are disappearing that many biologists consider we are today going through yet another major extinction, a sixth, which is comparable in scale to the rest, with the difference, of course, that this one has been caused by us. The other metaphor, the Anthropocene, is a suggested new name for the epoch in the geological timescale in which we are currently living, which at the moment goes by the name of the Holocene, meaning in Greek, most recent. The idea is that we have entered an age in which the human impact on the planet is now so great that it has become the period's key defining characteristic. And yet, of all this terrible damage to the natural world that we have caused and are causing, that's not the half of it. For what we're also faced with is the fundamental destabilization of the atmosphere, the dislocation of the Earth's natural systems, which have kept the planet fit for life for millions of years, with climate change. We are faced, as you probably all know, with the potentially catastrophic retention of more and more of the sun's heat in the Earth's atmosphere by the greenhouse gases, which are an inevitable byproduct of our industry and energy generation. We are already experiencing remarkable rises in global temperature. As you probably all know as well, the five hottest years in the global temperature record, which goes back to 1850, have all occurred since 2010. And some temperature events in this past summer of 2018 were unprecedented, like temperature records of 90 degrees Fahrenheit north of the Arctic Circle. And we are, of course, looking at further rises, which will lead to much more extreme weather events, from storms to floods to droughts, and potentially disastrous rises in global sea levels. And perhaps most damaging of all, one of what Donald Rumsfeld famously called the unknown unknowns, some major breakdown in the climate system, which we cannot even predict. As well as, of course, even more damage to the natural world that global warming itself will cause. Now, some people see climate change as a problem on its own and separate from the destruction of nature, not least because global warming threatens all human society directly in a way that the trashing of the natural world may not seem to. And some people see it as a problem with its own causes, such as the writer Naomi Klein, who many of you will be familiar with, who famously and very persuasively sees the cause as capitalism. She sees global warming as the great battle between capitalism and the planet. But I don't share that view, because you can get global warming and the destruction of the natural world with the command economy just as much as you can with capitalism. I personally see global warming and the destruction of nature as coming from exactly the same cause, which is what I mentioned at the outset, the now overwhelming scale of the human enterprise. I personally see the ultimate cause of the threat to the planet as the unstoppable rise in human numbers. World population doubled in my lifetime, from 3 billion in 1960 to 6 billion in the year 2000, and it's now just under 7.7 billion. 15 years ago, the United Nations thought world population would stabilise in mid-century at about 8.9 billion in 2050, perhaps reaching 9.1 billion by 2100. But after a new in-depth analysis in 2014, it doesn't think that anymore. In its latest assessment, published last year, the UN sees human numbers rising to 9.8 billion in 2050 and 11.2 billion in 2100, and some estimates suggest even more. So in the 21st century, world population will in effect have doubled again. Now, it's very hard to talk morally about the growing world population as a problem, because you run the risk of demonising people for the simple fact of their coming into existence. But the facts are stark and unignorable, and it can only be the case that our vastly growing numbers will feed the vast increase in human activities, which is what is increasingly consuming the planet, which is our only home. Now, much of the damage we are doing can be tackled, and much will be tackled. And more than anything else, I want to help tackle it, and we're going to talk about this. But if I have a pessimism, it is that the central problem, the very mushrooming scale of human activities, may be unaddressable. And so if I am asked the question, have we killed the planet, the question for this conversation this evening, my answer is not yet. But that, as I said at the outset, we have set in motion processes which threaten irreversible damage to the Earth and which may be very hard, if not impossible, to stop.
Thank you for thoroughly frightening us, Mike. So what have our responses been so far?
Well, you would have to say that human society has reacted really quite forcefully to the challenges presented by the growth in human activities, the potentially damaging growth in human activities. We haven't just let it happen. We've created a number of fairly profound ideas to tackle it, perhaps starting with the report in 1987 on the Commission on the Environment and Development, led by Gro Harlem Brundtland, called Our Common Future, which came up with the idea of sustainable development. And sustainable development is a very powerful idea, and it's done some marvellous things. One of the things it has done is it has implanted in all governments and businesses the idea that the environment has to be considered, even if only on the surface. That's an idea that wasn't there before. But sustainable development as a policy which seeks to let the Earth carry human society and the world economy carry on growing to help take people out of poverty, what it hasn't succeeded in doing is stopping the general march towards destruction, other than at the margins. And we have other ideas. What has succeeded sustainable development is the idea of ecosystem services, which many of you will be familiar with, which in some ways you might think has a better chance of success, because the weakness of sustainable development is it appeals to people's better side. People have to do the right thing for sustainable development to work. And as the Christian Church knows only so well, people don't always do the right thing. Whereas ecosystem services, finding out what the planet can do for us and preserving those aspects of it, appeals directly to our self-interest. So somebody like Adam Smith would think it has a much better chance of success. And even if you go down to a sort of technical level, the way we are addressing climate change, we are addressing it very thoroughly, even if not successfully. We signed the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change in 1992, and ever since then, we have been developing policies to stop the rise of greenhouse gases going into the atmosphere. And in 2015, we signed a treaty in Paris when, for the first time, all nations of the world pledged that they would cut their greenhouse gases. So these are big things, but the problem is that they haven't been able to stop the general tendency, the slide towards the degradation and potential destruction of the natural world and its life support system.
So the reason they're failing, the reason they've failed...
Well, I think there are two reasons these answers have not been successful. One is the sheer scale of the problem. The problems are gigantic. They are globally... They are worldwide. And as I said, the central core of the problem may... In effect, be almost unaddressable. It is just something that has happened in history, that the human species of all the radiated life forms on the Earth suddenly outgrew everything else. But the other reason, really, is that people don't care about it. Not enough people care about it. I mean, I imagine most of the people in this chapel this evening do care about it, otherwise you wouldn't be here. And we sometimes think that... environmentalists are very influential, but people who care about the environment on the whole are small in number compared to the rest of the population. I don't know how many of you are familiar with Abraham Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Some people are nodding. You know that what we seek to satisfy are our basic needs first. We seek to protect the pound in our pocket. We seek to protect our health, and we seek to protect the education of our children. And as you go up this narrowing pyramid, everything else gets... you get towards the less and less and less important things. And when you've satisfied all your basic needs, you reach the area which is altruistic. And so, in a time of plenty, a time of economic growth and stability, you find that many people support the environment, but in times of difficulty, the environment, like advertising, is one of the first concerns that's cut. And, you know, just think for yourself. There aren't really any votes in the environment. So the fact that an awful lot of people don't really care, or perhaps are ignorant of, but don't really care about what is happening to the natural world, is one of the ways I saw it as the principal problem.
So in your book, you're suggesting something completely different that hasn't been articulated before.
Well, maybe, yeah. I mean, what I suggested in writing this book, because I've spent 25 years as a journalist covering the policies, you know, from the Earth Summit on and from before then, that have been laid down as a result of enormous intellectual effort from dedicated people, and yet they haven't stopped the destruction. And I just think, I said that there's perhaps another way of looking at this, which is not to think about what we do, but rather to think about who we are. And most of us probably think we know who we are. But in the last 40 years, a recognition has developed that there is a lot more to us than we previously understood. And this has come around through evolutionary biology, which you all know has explained how the peacock got its tail and the parrot got its beak. But it also explains behaviours as well as physical features. And it also has increasingly been taken to explain human behaviours. And if we look at one branch of evolutionary biology, which is evolutionary psychology, what this tends to suggest to us is that events which happened in the Pleistocene, the longer era of the Ice Ages, 50,000 generations, perhaps a million years, the psyche that we developed in those 50,000 generations and the mental processes and some of the attitudes are more important to us even now than the mental attitudes we've developed in the last 500 generations since farming began and with it civilization. That in the years we spent as hunter-gatherers are absolutely key underneath to our psychology more than the generations we've spent in civilization. And one of the truths that we are starting to perceive is that because of that, we have deep inside us an innate and very powerful but empirically true bond with the natural world, which is very important to us. And it's not always visible, and it's been overlain by 500 generations of civilization, and it's further overlain even today by the frenzied brouhaha of modern life. But it is there. And if we have left the natural world and gone into our cities, the natural world has not left us. And it is this bond with the natural world that I sort of set out to explore and to see if, as individuals, and this is not policy, you cannot shout this from a platform, you cannot put it into a draft government bill, but if, as individuals, we were able to locate our bond with the natural world, we might start to see the natural world in a different way.
Right. So can you bring that to life for us, Mike, as you do in the book? You tell your own story. Tell something of your own story to show us what you mean so that we can actually have some shared experience of it rather than hear it as a theory.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that led me to this line of thought was, as I got older, it started to seem more and more remarkable that we were capable, some humans were capable, of loving the natural world. I mean, it's only the milieu from which we emerged. You might think, why shouldn't we regard it just as an environment in which we can take advantage of its bounty and avoid its dangers, like an otter does in its river, but why should we love it? And I actually posit the view that can an otter love its river? Well, we don't know, but we think perhaps it can't. And so one of the things I suggested in this book was that one of the ways in which we might find or seek to realise that we have this bond with the natural world is the joy that it can inspire us, is inspiring us on occasions. That sometimes experiences in nature, be it with a landscape or even a single species, can inspire a tremendous feeling of what I call it a happiness that is a serious business. And I began to feel that this was the way in to understand it. So I started looking at the way I had felt joy in the natural world ever since I was a boy. And my thought was that if it wasn't that bond with the natural world deep inside us that inspired this joy, well, what was it? Because once, when Christianity still ruled supreme, as it were, we had an easy explanation for the fact that we could love the natural world because it was the Lord's creation, and we were loving and taking delight in his own creation. But you know, it's hard to say that in a marvellous place such as this. As Christianity fades for many people, it is harder to explain. But it seems to me that the bond with the natural world is what explains it. And it's interesting to take the case of something like Wordsworth. Wordsworth, really, his whole life was governed by his intense love of nature, which he not only celebrated, but as it were, erected into a philosophy. It has seemed to me over the last few years that Wordsworth felt this feeling intensely, but he didn't actually know why he was feeling it. It was a mystery. I mean, there's the famous lines from Tintern Abbey that some of you will know. I have felt a pleasure which... it's in here. Hang on a sec. And I have felt a presence that disturbs me with the joy of elevated thoughts, a sense sublime of something far more deeply interfused, whose dwelling is the light of setting suns, and the round ocean and the living air, and the blue sky and in the mind of man, a motion and a spirit that impels all thinking things, all objects of all thought, and rolls through all things. And that's Wordsworth looking down on Tintern Abbey and wrestling with why he feels so strongly and not being able to quite explain it. And I have thought subsequently, wouldn't like this to be a sort of example of hubris, but I have thought, well, you didn't know about the bond of the 50,000 generations. And that's what, for me, does explain why we can feel so strongly, because the essence of it is that the natural world is still a part of us, and without it, without our feeling for the natural, it's our home. That's the essence of it. It's our spiritual home. The natural world in the Pleistocene is where we evolved as people. It's where our sensibilities evolved. It's where we learned our metaphors and our comparisons, strong as an oak and slender as a reed. It is how our imaginations grew and were defined. And we cannot really, I don't think, be at home in our psyches without in some way coming home to nature. But you wanted me to...
I want to tell you a story. The red shanks.
Well,
the colour blue.
No. well, you know, I have in this book just instance some examples of the joy that I have felt myself in the natural world, and saying to any reader, as you may yourself have felt. I mean, I did say the first time, well, what I personally fell in love with nature in strange circumstances. When I was seven, my mother had a mental breakdown and went to a mental hospital, and my father was away at sea. And myself and my brother, who was a year old, I was seven and he was eight, we were sent to live with an aunt. And this is in the Wirral on Merseyside. And whereas my brother was completely devastated by my mother's disappearance, he was destabilized really for the rest of his life. In my own case, I was completely indifferent. I felt completely indifferent that my mother had disappeared. And when we went to live with my aunt, it was in a greener area than we had grown up in. And in the next door but one house, two doors away, leaning over the garden wall, was a buddleia bush, which, as many of you will know, is a famous attractant of Lepidoptera. And on the second or third morning that I was there, I ran out into the street to play, and I found this buddleia bush, and this is in August 1954, covered with butterflies. And it was covered with the most splendid and colourful of the British Lepidoptera, the quartet that of the Nymphalidae, the, the Red Admiral, the small tortoiseshell, the peacock and the painted lady. And I couldn't really believe what I was seeing, these wonderful colours. And in the space inside me, where I should have had feelings, where I should have had feelings for my mother who had disappeared, that was an empty slate. And the butterflies seemed to fill it. And so, as I say in the book, at the age of 7, when I was a skinny kid in short pants, butterflies entered my soul. And that was the beginning for me, that in strange circumstances I fell in love with nature. And Claire has mentioned one or two other things, but when I first consciously experienced, I think you would want me to refer to this, what I would describe as joy in the natural world. I was a bird watcher on the Dee estuary, which is to the west of the Wirral. The Dee estuary is the boundary between North Wales and Cheshire, and it's very beautiful, and even today it has an aspect of wilderness. And as I began to explore it at the age of 15 with my first pair of binoculars, first of all, it was the birds that I was looking at, and the Dee estuary has wonderful flocks of water birds, of waders and of wildfowl. But I gradually, over a summer into the autumn, began to appreciate and love not just the birds, which had taken me there as a junior bird watcher, but also the place itself. And one of the things that drew me into a love of the place was the music of the birds. I mean, many of you will know, but some wading birds have heart-stopping cries. I mean, the curlew in particular, now so threatened. The curlew's bubbling, which Dylan Thomas refers to in one of his poems, this lovely musical bubbling which can change the whole atmosphere of a landscape, and the oyster catchers with a sort of sharp peep. And Claire did mention, there was one in particular called the redshank. Redshank is a sandpiper, and some of you will know it, but it has the most haunting, mournful, melodious cry when it takes flight. And I say in the book that unusually, the guide that we all used in those days to as the field guide, which was the field guide to the birds of Britain and Europe, described its cry, and the cry of noting down the cry of birds is very much an exact science, but it did it fairly accurately, and it said it was a musical down slurred tlu hu hu. That's T-L-E-U-H-U-H-U. And I thought this was rather charming. It was like seeing a verb from an exotic language, tluhuhu, the verb to hunt in whatever. But if you hear it, it goes tluhuhu, like that, tluhuhu. And one day when I was 15, and this is what Claire's referring to, I had gone there to the Dee estuary, always on my own. And it was a strange day. It was a sunny day with a strong wind in October. And I was coming back along the embankment. And I started to hear redshank calls, which were being borne on the wind towards me down the whole estuary. These tluhuhus. And I say in the book, it suddenly seemed to pull everything together, this ethereal, mournful fluting. It pulled together the distant mountains of Wales and the sea at the end and this broad expanse of the estuary. And I sat down listening to it, and I say in the book that previously I would have described the Dee estuary as broad or flat or green or wet sometimes. But now I thought it was something else. I thought it was wonderful. And I sort of sat there on the embankment listening, and I consciously felt, at the age of 15, I consciously felt joy. And that's one of the first times that I felt it.
So you say very movingly and powerfully at the end of the book, let this joy be engaged, let this love that arises from the joy be engaged, let it be energized, let it be articulated, because this will work where all these other more rational approaches simply haven't. So just to help us with that, can you describe what you felt when you were shown, I'm not going to pronounce it correctly, Samangyeom?
Oh yes, that's in South Korea.
In South Korea.
Yeah, I mean, just to say, you make it sound almost like a policy prescription, and I mean that in the nicest way possible, but
we'll come to that.
I can't offer any policy prescriptions in terms of, you know, what this book might offer. It's for individuals, for their own lives. It's not something, as I said earlier, you can put in a draft bill or have it as a slogan. It's just to look at your own lives and see, is it possible to find something in the natural world that I have done? And I think it is, but although one of the things I say is, I think you have to go out there to find it. I don't think you can experience this in a TV wildlife documentary, however good it is. You know, David Attenborough is wonderful. I agree with everybody. I'm glued to it. But in our own individual lives, to find to find that connection with the natural world, I think you have to go out there. Claire referenced, there's a section in the book about Saemangeum. Saemangeum is an estuary in South Korea, and it's been destroyed. And it's probably the biggest destruction of an estuary that's ever taken place on the planet. And it probably held every year about 450,000 waders, and it was a key stopping place on what's called the East Asian Australasian Flyway. All the wading birds, all the shore birds of Australia down here and Burma down here, every spring they all fly up north and they go to the tundra at the top of the world to breed, because you've got long hours of daylight, you've got very few predators, you've got overabundant insect life, and then they come back. And it's a long journey of 5,000 or 6,000 miles. And the key stopping place is the Yellow Sea in the middle. And Saemangeum was probably the biggest estuary on the Yellow Sea. But it was destroyed by the South Korean government. It was they put a seawall across it until it just dried out and became nothing. And for me, it meant a lot to me, because the Dee had been my estuary. One of the things I say in the book is that not many people care about estuaries. We don't write songs about estuaries, do we? We're going down the river. We don't say going down the estuary. I've never heard anyone sing a blues about an estuary. So I thought nobody cared about estuaries. But this was what could have happened to the Dee, and the Dee is still there now. So I went out there just to bear witness to it. Perhaps there's one thing I might add. One of the things about suggesting that we have a bond with the natural world, what's becoming clear in the last 30 or 40 years is that this is not some mystic bond, which are, you know, fine and great, but like less modern, more, don't want to use the right word, but more primitive peoples. If that, you know, I don't want to be patronising, but peoples other than modern civilised peoples, like native peoples of Australia and North America, clearly have immediate relationships with the natural world. But even with us, in, say, the West, it's clear, and increasingly clear from many studies, that this bond is real. It's empirically true. And one of the first things that brought this to light was a paper published in Science in 1984 with one of those titles that suddenly make everybody all around the world sit up and take notice. And this paper's headline was, "View through a window may influence recovery from surgery." And it was written by an American architect who specialised in hospital design called Roger Ulrich. And what Roger Ulrich had found in a hospital in Pennsylvania which treated people for gastric diseases was that one side of the ward where they recovered had a view, unfortunately, of a brick wall, and the other side had a view over a park. And with 9 years of data, so it couldn't possibly be falsified, he found that the people who were fortunate enough to have the view over the park recovered more quickly, had fewer post-operative complications, needed fewer painkillers, and left hospital much earlier than the people who, alas, only had the brick wall to look upon. And that was the beginning of, perhaps, of the realisation, and there's now a flood of studies about it, and now we are starting to build into our health policies the fact that contact with nature has a real effect. That was the beginning of the understanding that there is something in the natural world which can actually physically affect us. And to me, that's the same as the bond I've been talking about.
Well, thanks very much, Mike. I am just going to push you with my final question about policy, because of our audience and because of the people whom the Institute seeks to serve. So what would you say to the policymaker who may be in this chapel tonight, who agrees with everything that you say, who feels a deep love for nature, but cannot see how to change what she does at her desk tomorrow?
Well, I do not know if discovering a deeper love and discovering our bond with the natural world can be translated into political terms. I do not know if that is possible. Maybe the two things are at odds with each other, I'm not sure. But certainly, we have very good policies in place. I mean, if you look at how we're trying to tackle global warming, the Paris Treaty of 2015 was a wonderful achievement, largely by Barack Obama. And it was, it's funny, you had two completely different responses to it. The environmentalists, the NGOs, all said it's not enough, and the people who negotiated it all slapped each other on the back in Paris. And both are true, because it is a necessary but not sufficient condition for us to tackle global warming. It was for the first time the 195 member states of the United Nations all agreed that they would cut their CO2 emissions. Now, that had never been done before. But it was clear that the pledges that everybody was required to make before the treaty were not enough. The pledges, if all carried out to the letter, which is a big if, would only slow down global warming to 2.7 degrees above the pre-industrial, which is potentially catastrophic. So what the treaty has is it has a ratcheting up process, and when the members come back in 2020, they're all obliged to deliver. They are all obliged to deliver enhanced pledges, which we hope will get us on the way. I mean, I personally think one of the problems with global warming is it's been, our action, a response to it, has been based on prediction. It's been based on prophecy. It's been based on supercomputer models of the global climate telling us X, Y, and Z is going to happen in 2050. And nobody listened. And why should you? You know, it's a long way off. But something strange happened in 2018, I think, in the summer. And I wrote a piece about this in The Guardian. This year, for the first time, our response to global warming began to be defined not by prediction, but by observation. For the first time, people started looking out their windows and seeing what was happening with the global climate and thinking something wasn't normal. And in what I thought was a major landmark moment, the Sun, a Rupert Murdoch paper, devoted its whole front page to the overheating planet at the end of July. So I think as things become more visible, I think more people will be prepared to take action. But I know I've gone off slightly. To get back to your question, to the policymaker here who feels the thing is. Maybe the answer is that it can't be translated into action, because this is a prescription, not for action. This is a prescription. It's private, really. It's not public. It's a prescription for individuals to look at their own lives and to look at to look at how they relate to the environment and perhaps to explore it, and maybe they will find something quite remarkable out there. And as I say in the book, even if one person feels like that has real worth. But if many people feel like that, that would have real power, because ordinary people's feelings are the beginnings of political will. So I don't think I can say to a policymaker, if you were to go down this road and to discover something about yourself and the fact that the environment is inside you, it goes back 50,000 generations from when we were formed in it, when we were wildlife, when we were just part of the world. If you were to discover that, I cannot say that It would make a difference to the policies that in the real world that you are pursuing, but I think I would say that it would make a difference to you. And if enough people were to feel it, then it would begin to make a difference, perhaps, to the world.
Thank you. So now what I'd like us to do just for 2 minutes is to turn to the person sitting next to you and have just a word about what this has evoked in you and what you might like to ask Mike, just for 2 minutes. Gives you a breather, a 2-minute breather.
All right, yeah, okay.
Thank you. That was really
is that all right?
Authentic.
Hey?
Authentic.
Is that the word?
That's the word, yeah. Somebody who's going to ask the first question.
Okay.
He's from the FCO.
Oh, right.
He's one of our fellows.
Oh, right.
He's just come back from Romania.
Oh, right.
That really was great. Thank you.
Okay. Is it all right?
Right, thank you very much. I'm going to take two or three questions or comments at once, and we better keep them brief, otherwise we won't have time for a glass of wine. So there's one here and one here. Thank you. Would you stand up, and if you would like to, say who you are.
Thank you. Paul Brummel from the Foreign Office. I mean, that was just a beautiful lyrical presentation about the importance of discovering our bonds with nature, rediscovering our bonds with nature, and experiencing the joy that brings. But you started with some really, really sobering statistics about population growth and increased demands of humans on the environment. So I think my question is, if we are all successful in that process of discovering our bonds with nature, is that enough to save the planet?
Thank you. And the lady here, please.
Thank you. Sarah Parkin, the Sustainable...
Sarah, hello.
Hello. Sustainability Literacy Project.
Yes.
As you know, Mike, I have written a fair few manifestos in my time about what we could and should do. But I'm currently... thinking quite hard about the fact that you said I've spent 50 years and really not accomplished anything nearly enough campaigning for the environment. And I think one of the reasons is that we do not think in outcomes as a species. We don't think what would good look like for us 5, 10, 15, 20, 50 years from now. And I agree totally with all the things you've said, excuse me, but I do think people need something, a common purpose, a common goal. And what do you think about the idea of Ed Wilson, who is an American biologist, whom I love dearly, and if anybody doesn't know him, read about him and the stuff that he does. He's wonderful. And he's got this big campaign, he says it's his last, which is for half an Earth being given back to nature. Now, whether it is half an Earth nature needs or not, don't know, but the point is, it's something to head for. And the sort of things you would have to do to release or to take us out of impact on half the Earth and give it back to nature actually resolves quite a lot of the other problems that we have. But the question is really, do we need some sort of congealing, motivating, something that brings us all into a common project? And whether it's our window box, our back garden, a local park, a national park, or the sea, or whatever, we can all contribute by giving back as much as we can to nature.
Thank you very much, Mike.
Well, to refer to the gentleman from the Foreign Office, I've always admired the way that the Foreign Office has dealt with the environment. I once had quite a close relationship with the head of the Foreign Office Environment Department a long time ago. He used to leak me stuff when I was on the Times. So I am well disposed to you and your colleagues. You said, would it be enough? Well, it'd be a start, wouldn't it? I mean, the way that people feel governs the way that they act. If we take the difference between Obama and Donald Trump, okay? These are two very different individuals, and when you get to the top of the pyramid and the peak, the way you feel clearly can have enormous impacts on the real world. Obama wasn't an environmentalist. He wasn't a boyhood bird watcher. He came out of Chicago, okay? But he did get the fact that with climate change, it was real and that you had to do something about it. And so what he did was he was largely responsible for the 2015 Paris Treaty because he got this earlier agreement with the Chinese. So if you have, I think that how people care really matters. I mean, one of the things that I was concerned about for a long time was the Catholic Church. And I used to write for the Tablet, which is, you know, read in the Vatican as well as in Westminster Cathedral. And I wrote two long pieces in 2005 and 2006 saying that the church's response to the environmental crisis was wholly inadequate and it was going to lose its support because the most important thing in the past for the church had been evil and human suffering, but now the major thing that was going to cause human suffering in the 21st century was not man's inhumanity to man so much as something like climate change, and the church had nothing to say about that. And I ended the second piece with saying, it's just a dream, but maybe one day an ecological pope will come along. And lo and behold, in 2015, we have Pope Francis, who produces Laudato Si, the papal encyclical on the environment, which overturns all the things that have been made caring for the environment difficult for Christians, especially as we've discussed. Is it Genesis 1:28?
Read the second creation story, not the first.
Where it says, you know, have dominion over the earth and subdue it. It uses the word subdue. And you know, this has been really, really damaging. And he actually said, I think it's paragraph 63, and I nearly fell off my chair when I read that. He actually said the idea that we have to have dominion over the planet and subdue it is wrong. He actually said that. So that's one individual doing that. And on the other hand, you've got Trump, who said he will take America out of the Paris Agreement. Okay. So my answer to you would be that is it enough to feel that? It's certainly, if more people felt it, it has to have an effect. To turn to Sarah, I think the answer, if there were an overwhelming project that everybody could get behind, I think yes, of course, that could have a great effect. I mean, something you will remember from your time in the Green Party, no doubt, is the campaign for clean air and the way lead-free petrol was brought in Britain. And that was one, you know, fairly small NGO who succeeded completely in persuading the government to take lead out of petrol. And it had an enormous effect. So it is clearly the case that determined people with concern for the public good can do great things.
Thank you. Lady at the back there. Yeah. And perhaps another one. Anyone else? There. Next. Thank you.
Good night. Thank you for your works. I'm Jessica. I'm a student at NYU. I wanted to ask you, you mentioned the idea of sustainable development and its weaknesses as well. So I was wondering if you believe that economic development and the environment are necessarily in an oppositional relationship of...
Sorry, I can't hear you very well.
Oh, okay, sorry. Is that better?
Can you speak a bit more slowly? Sorry.
Oh, sure. Is that better?
Yes.
Okay. So I wanted to ask you if you believe that economic development and environment are necessarily in an oppositional relationship, right, or yeah, if there's a different way of looking at it.
Okay. Well,
thank you. Wait. One more over here first. Okay. So you got that?
Yeah, okay.
Thank you. Hello, Kitty Buchanan-Gregory from the Cabinet Office. It comes back to what you're saying about the number of people who care or who don't feel it are less than those who don't care. So they don't care if an estuary is built on or a rainforest is destroyed. So perhaps what we can do, and it becomes part of a policy, is to change that through education and actually building in the understanding of nature, the exposure to nature, and teaching children to care and
Absolutely.
Putting them in places
Absolutely.
Where the passion becomes part of them.
Yeah.
And then that has a detrimental effect in a positive way on day-to-day activities and long-term effect.
Yeah.
Is that something that you think the education of nature should be more mandatory?
Yes, I do, but I've got to answer you second. to the lady at the back. Well, clearly, in the decades after the Second World War, as the world economy grew, it grew six times bigger, and as development started, clearly clashes began with between development and the environment. And, for example, I went to the rainforest in Brazil. I went to the Amazon for an extended period for my newspaper in 1977. And that was just at the beginning of deforestation, where all these settlers were coming up from the south. They all wore straw hats, I remember, and they were all doing slash and burn agriculture. And it was like seeing seeing it very directly. It was like looking at the aftermath of an armoured battle. And the Brundtland Commission was set up.
It's gone.
I can use my voice. Oh, it's back.
We're back. Thanks.
The Brundtland Commission and the Brundtland Report of 1987 was about environment and development, and the Earth Summit of 1992 was about environment and development. But the developmentalists felt that the environmentalists had had the best of it in 1992, so they were still at odds, and they convened really the Johannesburg conference in 2002, as it were, to get their own back. What has brought the two sides together more than anything is the realization with in the past, I have heard development mentalists going back 20 years say that the environment didn't matter, saying it was for middle class bird watchers, that it didn't really in any way affect the concerns of ordinary people, and so they weren't bothered about something like global warming. But in the noughties, people began to appreciate, and one of the people who appreciated this most of all was Gordon Brown, who I'm told on good authority, when environment and climate change was being discussed in cabinet meetings in the early noughties, used to bite his nails and look out of the window. But later, from about 2005, 2006, the people began to realise that the people that global warming was going to hurt more than anybody else were the poorest people in the world. So it was the developing countries that were going to suffer as a result of climate change. And so the two things have come more and more together. And also, the thing we briefly talked about, the idea of ecosystem services, that is also bringing home to developmentalists who say, I give an example in the book. Okay. Say you've got a city near the coast, and the coastline near the city is fringed with mangroves, which are trees rooted in seawater, with brackish water with very, very shallow roots. And a lot of mangrove swamps, because it's shallow, have been torn up and grubbed out to make way for shrimp farms, okay? Because that's an easy hit in developmentalist terms, okay? So, but what mangroves do is they prevent things like storm surges. They absorb them. So what if you have the city X in coastal zone X, and it has its mangroves, and all its mangroves are bulldozed so that you can have shrimp farms, maybe, let's say, making $5 million over 5 years. But then a typhoon happens or a storm surge happens, and the storm surge rolls over the shrimp farms where the mangroves would have absorbed it and decimates the city behind. And the city behind decides that it has to build a seawall to prevent future storm surges. And the seawall over 5 years, how much will that cost you? Will it be a lot? Let's say it's $500 million. So you can ask the question. So that means the replacement value of the mangroves is $500 million. And you can ask the question. You did away with $500 million worth of mangroves for $5 million worth of shrimp farms? And these sort of questions have made people stop and think. I mean, I could go on about that, but I think I'd better answer the other question. Yes, I wholly agree with what you say. And as you may know, the environmentalist doing the curlew.
Fiona.
Mary Colwell. Thank you, Jeremy. Mary Colwell has a campaign for a GCE in nature. And with Caroline Lucas, the Green MP, they are going to see John Gummer about this fairly soon. And I think what you say, absolutely true. If people grow up not knowing about the environment, they're not going to care about it. And we have moved away from that. I mean, I am of the generation that had nature tables in schools and harvest festivals. And a really awful thing that led to a lot of protests was the change in the new edition of the Oxford Junior Dictionary in 2007, where a whole series of words to do with nature, like acorn, were taken out of the book and replaced with words like broadband. This is for children. Robert McFarlane has written a marvellous book about this called The Lost Words, which many people are trying to get put into school. So the answer I give to you is I agree with you 100%.
And on that note, I think we're going to thank Mike and bring the evening to a close.